today we're going to today we're going to start talking about estimating betas better, because I think in practice lots of people use betas, but they use them almost as numbers that come from a service and they don't think through them. So today we're going to try to establish an intuitive basis for why we look at betas, or what a beta is, and also develop a framework for estimating betas better than the way we do it right now. So we're going to talk about bottom-up betas. And for those of you who have kind of been in my corporate finance class, it's very simple. Essentially, rather than trusting a single regression to deliver a beta for your company, you look at the businesses your company is in and you build up. So today's questions are going to be about that process, even though we haven't talked about it. So let's start with the first one. Bottom-up beta is an alternative to regression beta. Okay? And in coming up with the bottom-up beta for a company, you are going to have to make some choices about how to estimate that bottom-up beta. So generically, let's assume I give you three choices of groups of companies that you're going to get a bit. So here are the three choices. One is you can get a small sample of companies that look very much like yours in terms of market cap. That's your first choice. The second is a much larger sample where you got to give, given what sense of companies might be bigger or smaller or riskier or higher growth. Okay? Or maybe I can find one company just like your company. So small sample, big sample, one company just like yours. If your objective is estimating a bottom-up beta, so keep the focus there, which of these three is going to be your best choice? Because each of you is going to have to face this when you value your company. Small sample, big sample, one company. Anybody want to try? Yes, Joe.
Should you go for the large sample?
And tell me why.
Because when you have a larger sample size, it kind of gets rid of some of that noise problem.
In fact, why do we not like regression betas? One slice of history. Strange things can happen during that slice, right? And so replacing it with another beta is not going to replace the problem. A small sample is still going to have those issues. So this actually opens you up to going on Capital IQ and finding 500 companies. They might not be like yours, but you're hoping and praying that the law of large numbers works out, that the average is going to be a number that reflects it. So we'll come back and talk about, should we go with a sample of 500 or 50 or 5, but larger samples are better than smaller ones. So let's build on that. Now you want to find comparable companies. Why? To estimate a beta again. So keep your focus. This is not about PE ratios or any of the pricing issues. Just about this. So which of the following would you want to have in your comparable firm? Does it have to be a firm in the same industry group, a firm listed in the same market, a firm with a similar market cap, none of the above, or all of the above? See the question I'm asking? What exactly does comparable mean if you're talking about comparable firms to come up with a beta? I have a software company. Do I have to say with other software companies? That's the question I'm asking. I have a Brazilian company. Do I have to stick with other Brazilian companies? I have a small company. Should I be looking at just small companies? Because the decisions I make about comparable are going to be driven by that. What do you think?
And why
the industry group? What's so special about it? What are we implicitly assuming when we use the industry group? Let me play devil's advocate. Let's suppose you're looking at the beta of a consulting firm. And this consulting firm gets 100% of its revenues from banks. It does banking consulting. Should I be looking at consulting firms or should I be looking at banking? In other words, it's not the industry group that matters. It's other companies that are exposed to the same market risk as you are. I'm going to give you an example that I gave you in corporate finance that you might or might remember, might or might not remember. It's about the time I had to estimate the value for a 5-star restaurant in New York City. A friend of a friend said, can you look at this restaurant and give them? Because they were being approached by a restaurant chain that was going to buy it, and they didn't trust the numbers that were coming from the bankers. So I said, okay, I'll give you a valuation. So I sat down to value the 5-star restaurant. And of course, it's a privately owned restaurant, so you can't get a beta from Bloomberg even if you wanted to. So I looked up the betas of restaurants, publicly traded restaurants in the U.S. And you know what I saw on that list, right? Who's going to show up on the list? TGI Fridays, McDonald's, Applebee's, etc. Remember, this is a five-star restaurant in New York City. What drives revenues at a five-star restaurant has almost nothing to do with what drives revenues at a fast food chain. So you know what I use as my comparable firms? One was actually I went down Fifth Avenue and started, essentially, you can take that stretch of Fifth from 59th to 55th, and you can pretty much get your, or if you prefer, open up to the second page of the New York Times in the inside. You have the Van Cleef's, the Winston. I mean, it's like, the expensive part of town. I mean, I've never shopped any of these places, but I don't care. That's the other was I started to ask a different question. Who exactly eats at a five-star restaurant in New York City? You know what it'll cost you? $200 without wine. The only people who eat at these restaurants are people spending other people's money. That's the way I see it. It's the same people who fly business class to London for $8,000. If it was your money, I don't care how much money you have, this is an absurdly ridiculous waste of money. So I started thinking about who has that much of other people's money to spend. And there are only two groups of people in New York City who have that much of other people's money to spend. One is lawyers. But they're not publicly traded, so I got stymied on that one. The other is bankers. I actually ended up using the beta for investment banks as the beta for the restaurant. The guy said, I'm not an investment bank. I said, you are, you just don't know it yet. Because all you need to do is look at the bonuses at investment banks, and you can pretty much tell whether the restaurant is going to do well or badly. So it's almost a mindset change. We're forced, I think this comes from history. We tend to think in industry groups, I'm saying get out of that mindset, because what we're thinking about are other companies that do well when you do well and other companies that do badly when you do badly. That is your end game when you're thinking about betas, at least. We're also going to talk about the cost of debt. Far simpler than the cost of equity. But let's see if we can get an advanced view of how to estimate the cost of debt. So let's say you're estimating the cost of debt for a company. It has no bonds outstanding, no publicly traded debt. And let's face it, that's going to be true for 90% of the companies out there. There are no bonds outstanding. It has $1 billion in bank loans outstanding, carrying an interest rate of 4% and a remaining maturity of 8 years. So that's all it has, the bank loan. The loans were taken a couple of years ago when rates were low, and the risk-free rate right now is 5%. And I want you to estimate a cost of debt. And I say, look, I don't know what the rating is, but roughly speaking, if they borrow money today, it'll cost them about 2% over the risk-free rate. So you ready? All I want is a very specific answer. What is the pre-tax cost of debt for this company? And I'll give you the choices. You can take the 4% because that's what their existing debt is at. You can take 5% saying nobody can borrow less than the risk-free rate. I'm going to take at least that number. You can take the 7%, which is 5 plus the 2% default spread. You can try to play games by taking the 7 and the 4, adding them together and dividing by 2. Don't ask me where you're going with that one. Or maybe it's none of the above, and you have this incredibly creative way of coming up with the cost of debt. You see what the question I'm asking is? You have a book interest rate. You know what it is. You have a hypothetical cost of actually borrowing money today if you went out and borrowed money. You could take some number in the middle. You can take the risk-free rate. You have to decide what to use as your cost of debt. It's a fundamental decision that every CFO and every analyst has to face sometime during evaluation, and 3/4 of them get it wrong. Okay. How many think I can use the book interest rate? Because that's what I have debt at. I have 8 years left on the debt. It's at a low rate. Let me play devil's advocate. Why can't I use 4% as my cost of debt? Lead me through the logical fallacy of using the 4%. It's wrong, but tell me why. Why it's incorrect to use the 4% if that's the rate at which I can borrow at. Yes?
Because that was the historical rate. If you try,
but I've locked it in for the next 8 years, so why don't you give me the benefit of that historical rate? Well, I don't plan to. At least for the next 8 years, can I use 4%? It's a very, very... Now do you see why CFOs like to use book interest rates? Because they say, look, I've it locked in. It is a benefit to me. It is a benefit, right? The fact that I locked it. So let's first accept that proposition. Having the debt on your books at a low rate is a good thing because rates have gone up. And in fact, lots of companies are going out and borrowing money like crazy now because they think rates are low. Let's lock it in. shouldn't I give them that benefit? Yeah.
It's money that you already have. It's interest on money that you already have. It's not the cost of the new capital.
It doesn't matter because I'm valuing the company. Let's suppose I plan no growth. When I'm valuing the company, you know what I'm doing, right? I'm taking the existing assets and I'm saying, what would I pay for those assets now? I've given you the opening.
Oh, then you're not borrowing the money.
In other words, the fact that the... I'm not saying it's not a benefit. I'm saying if I have to value the business today, I can't lock in the rate at 4%. You still get the benefit in the form of lower default risk because you're able to borrow that money. But I can't give you a lower cost of capital right now because of it, because it's really not relevant. If I had to buy this company today, I have to go borrow money today at rates today. So book interest rate, even though CFO says, I have that money, it's locked in, can never be used as a cost of debt, and especially if it's less than the risk-free rate, because you don't even have a crutch to stand on now, right? Because if you set a pre-tax cost of debt for your company less than the risk-free rate, you've broken every finance rule in the book. Nobody can borrow at less than the risk-free rate if your risk-free rate is computed right. Your pre-tax cost of debt here is 7%, and you know how I'm going to reward you for the fact that you have this debt at a low interest rate? If I take your existing debt, which is at a 4% interest rate. And this is my last question. They say, what's the market value of this debt? Remember, the book value of the debt was $1 billion, right? The interest rate was 4% on the debt. What's the market value of this debt going to be? I know it's not traded, but if I were trading this debt, would you pay more than $1 billion or less than $1 billion for this debt?
More.
Think of buying a coupon bond, right? A 4% coupon rate, $1,000, and the interest rates today are 7%. What's going to happen to the price of your bond? It's going to drop below the face value. You're going to pay. So when I compute the market value of debt outstanding, it's going to be lower. So the way I'm going to reward you for the fact that you were able to lock this debt at a low rate is when I compute your debt ratio and how levered you are, you borrowed actually less money than you have on the books. And if you want to go out and borrow more money, you can actually do it because you've locked in this low rate debt. So I will find a way to reward you for the fact that you're able to borrow money at a low rate, but I'm not going to do it by giving you a low cost of debt. So we'll come back and talk about this because this is an issue we'll have to grapple with because we get so used to companies where you're given a rating and go look up the default spread that we get lazy. The reality is 9 out of 10 companies don't have bonds, don't have ratings, don't have a cost of debt you can look up. You have to do that extra work of assessing the default risk with the information you have, which is often financial information, income statements and balance sheets, and we'll devise a way of getting there. Any questions? Okay, so let's close this up and go back to where we left off. I kind of rushed through this last section when the last session, so let me go back to it. Now, often when you ask people what a beta is, they'll tell you it's a regression slope. It's a slope coefficient of running a regression of returns on the stock against returns on a market index, which leaves you at the mercy of whatever that regression tells you the beta of your company is. So the last thing I talked about at the end of the session, of the last session, was what is it that determines your beta? Why do some companies have high betas and others have low? And I said there are three things, or three decisions you make as a company that determine your beta. The first is, what exactly do you do? What products or services do you offer as a company? See, what do you mean? The more discretionary your products or services, the more your customers are willing to delay or defer buying it, the higher your beta will be as a company. So luxury retailers should have a higher beta than a department store. A department store should have a higher beta than a discount retailer because you're looking at different ends of the discretionary chain. High growth companies probably will have higher betas than stable companies because high growth companies often sell niche products, products that people will buy if they're doing well, but cut back on or delay buying if things are not going well. So the first thing you need to look at when you look at a company, before you look at the regression betas, ask yourself, what do they do? Now that's easy if you're looking at a Coca-Cola or a Walmart. It's more difficult if you're looking at a GE, right? Why? What does GE do? Actually, the question I should ask, what does GE not do, right? Because it's in 26 different businesses. We'll come back to that. Because then your beta is going to reflect the fact that you're in 26 different businesses, and some are discretionary, some are not, which means some are going to have high betas and others are going to have lower betas. So that's the first stop. Any questions of that? So how discretionary is your product or service? Econ 101 terms. What do we use to measure that? Elasticity of demand, right? That's the only reason those econ classes actually matter, is those little things you take and the rest is kind of useless, throw it out. If your product or service has an elastic demand, you'll have a higher beta. If it has an inelastic demand, you'll have a lower beta. Stop number one. Stop number two. Tell me something about your cost structure. The greater the proportion of your costs, which are fixed costs, the higher your beta will be as a company. Think of why. If you have a lot of fixed costs, what happens? When you're doing well, you make lots of money. When you're doing badly, you lose lots of money. Everything gets magnified. So 3% growth in revenues will translate into a 20% growth in operating income. A 3% drop in revenues could make you a loss-making firm. So the greater the proportion of your costs that are fixed costs, the higher beta. So if you're in a sector with a lot of fixed costs, airlines, steel, infrastructure, you should have higher betas than if you're in a business where there are very low fixed costs. So again, start thinking about real companies. Will that company have a high beta or a low beta? Third and final factor. Sometimes you can inflict pain on yourself by creating fixed costs you did not have until you went out and looked for it. And what I'm talking about is when you borrow money, that's exactly what you're doing, right? You create a fixed cost you did not have until you borrow the money, which is interest expenses. You got to make the interest expenses in good times and in bad times. So your equity earnings do much better in good times and much worse in bad times. What kind of business are you in? How much fixed cost do you have? How much have you borrowed? In fact, when I look at a company, rather than look at a regression beta and that Bloomberg page, that's what I start with. What does this company do? Because in a sense, then I know what type of beta I should see for this company. So if you give me Gucci and you say, I have a regression beta of 0.6, you know what my reaction is? I don't believe you. Even though there's a page right there that says 0.6, it is a regression beta. All kinds of bad things or strange things can happen. So step back from the ledge. Think about what drives a beta and then look at a regression beta if you want to. But at least you'll have a sense of perspective. Any questions about the determinants of betas? Notice what's not on this page. How good your management is doesn't affect the beta. Why not? Why? I mean, I've heard this from deep value investors that if you invest in a well-managed firm, it's less risky than if you invest in a badly managed firm. So let's say I throw that at you. Give me your counter. Why isn't that true? Go ahead, Joseph.
There can probably be a change in the path. I
mean, management. No, let's assume the good management is there to stay. I mean, let's face it. You offer me Google and HP. This is a no-brainer, right? Well managed, badly managed. Why isn't Google safer than HP simply because of management? Yes?
Because the beta should reflect your relative risk to the market, and the market risk is undiversified than the aggregate management team.
You're almost there. What is risk? It's what happens around your expectations, right? So if you have a really well-managed company, what are your expectations? They're going to reflect the good management, right? High margins, high return on capital. And a badly managed firm, you build in the expectations. If your expectations process is set up, the badly managed firm might be less risky because you've set expectations. You invest in Apple. Think of how high the ante is, right? Basically, iPhone 7 has to do what? It's got to do even better than the iPhone 6. The iWatch, everybody's got to be wearing it. This is a huge amount of risk you're facing. So the fact that you have a well-managed or a badly managed firm, that you have, I mean, so all the things we talk about, we bring them into the cash flows. I'm not saying it doesn't matter, but your beta is not going to be lower because you're a well-managed firm. Your beta is not going to be higher because it's a badly managed firm, because beta is about variance around the expectations, not whether you do well or badly per se. Joseph.
Talking about the nature of the product, what if your product is kind of teetering on discretionary? Or, for instance, like what if you're talking about a luxury product versus a super luxury product, and you're kind of on edge about which category it falls on?
So it's betas are a continuum, right? You don't have a high beta, low beta. We talk about in generic terms, betas can be 1.8, 2.1, 2.3, 2.5. So as long as you recognize, and also recognize if you're off, let's say you use 2 as your beta and it's really 2.2, it's going to have almost no effect on your value.
Okay.
Take that off your shoulders. You don't have to be right on the beta. You just have to have a sense of, am I getting a, You get into trouble if you give a beta of 0.6 to a company which should have a beta of 2 because you missed the point about where risk comes from. And that's the whole reason you want to do this, is to avoid that kind of mistake. Okay? Yes? Now, to back up, what kind of risk are you talking about?
Like, let's say you have two companies, like one is a utility run by a management team that just has that one utility, they're happy with it, they're just harvesting those cash flows, right, versus a management team of another utility where their strategy is to, like, go out and make acquisitions. And, like,
what kind of risk are you talking about when you do that? Remember, the beta measure is a very specific kind of risk, which is macroeconomic risk exposure. So if let's say utilities are a bad example simply because they're kind of stuck in place. Take two biotechnology companies, right? One is doing R&D on way out products and the other is going after commercial products. The first company is riskier if you think about total risk. But if you think about macroeconomic risk exposure, which is the only, betas don't carry that weight, right? So you're right, the first firm is riskier. So my suggestion is don't put all your money in that first firm. If you put all your money in that firm, betas don't even matter, right? But if you have a diversified portfolio, those two firms are no different in terms of risk. And that's the way to think about this particular component of risk.
So in like the way that we're approaching valuation, we wouldn't capture the risk from that strategy?
It's not that your way of approaching valuation. If you have a diversified portfolio, bringing that risk into your discount rate If you're not diversified, then none of these things matter, right? Because you shouldn't be using beta. But if you're diversified, then the risk you care about is the risk that you cannot diversify away. And that's why you need that focus. You have to make the decision up front as to whether you want to play the diversification game. If you don't, then you've got to come up with some company-specific risk measure that is going to be very, very idiosyncratic to you. Because you brought this very unique risk factor into play. And that might show up in the discount rate. We'll come back to this in the context of private company valuation. We have no choice because you're going to be exposed to all the risk. So I'm going to take it. Go ahead, Nick.
Does your geographic or trading market get dealt into beta? And if so,
Can I give you a very simple rule? Your currency choice shows up where? In your risk-free rate. Your business choice shows up in the beta. Your geographic choice shows up in the equity risk premium. Keep each to its place, because the minute you let them seep across, you're going to double count and triple count risk. It's a very simple rule, but it's easy to get, because I've seen analysts get it's a risky company, let's raise the beta. Okay, they raise the beta. Oh, risk-free rate, let's make it a higher number. They make up, they're adding things to every space. They're triple counting risk. So if you follow that rule, then things will stay kind of in their little spaces. And then if you want to change your mind, at least you know where to go to change your mind. So here's the three-step process I'm going to use to get a beta for your company. First step in the process is I want to get a beta for the business or businesses you operate in. So think of this as your business risk. Second step, I want to adjust the business beta for any differences in how you run these businesses. In other words, if you have higher fixed costs or lower fixed costs, in step two, I'd like to adjust for that. Third step, I want to bring in how much you borrow. Business, operating leverage, financial leverage. But here's the problem you face with operating leverage. It's not difficult adjusting for operating leverage. And remember the rationale here. If you have more fixed costs than the typical company, you should have a higher beta, right? So if I have 30 companies in the steel business, and I wanted to adjust for differences in operating leverage across those companies, here's all I need to know about each company. How much each company has as fixed costs, and how much it has is variable cost. You see the problem I'm going to face? I go to Capital IQ. I pull up every airline, and I say, tell me how much of the costs are fixed or variable. Try it out if you want. What do you get in Capital IQ? You get typical accounting numbers, SG&A. You can try to guess what's fixed, what's variable, but accountants don't do that. So when people ask me why I don't adjust for operating leverage, and most companies I don't, it's not because I don't know how, but because I don't have the data. If companies broke their costs down into fixed and variable costs, adjusting for operating leverage is very similar to adjusting for financial leverage. The fixed cost takes the form of debt. The variable cost takes the form of equity. and you can adjust a business beta for operating leverage. Okay? I'll tell you when I do try. When I know a company is an outlier. Example, let's take the airlines. What's the outlier in the airline business? At least for 30 years, there's been every case study, right? Southwest. And what makes Southwest different from almost every other airline? It has lower fixed costs by design. Why? The fixed cost starts off with the fact that for the longest time, if you flew a Southwest flight, you flew a 737. They had one aircraft. So one type of, not one aircraft flying all over the country. That'd be pretty busy. But one type of aircraft because it reduced their maintenance costs. They never, until very recently, they did not buy gates at any of the major airports. You flew into Midway and you flew into, or, you know. So essentially by doing that, they kept their fixed costs low because you didn't have to pay for all those gates. So by design, they went after the strategy of keeping fixed costs low. So if I were valuing Southwest, I know that if I take the beta for airlines and just plug it in there, I'm probably going to overestimate the cost of equity. So there I'm going to try to get a sense of how much lower their fixed costs are than the typical airline. But in 9 times out of 10, it's not worth the effort. So if somebody asks, how come you're not adjusting for operating leverage, turn it back on them. Say, I'm glad to do it. Why don't you come back to me with the fixed and variable cost for every company in the sector? Very quickly, they're going to say, you know what? Let's not adjust for operating leverage. Okay? You shouldn't be having to defend something that somebody just throws in there. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? If it's your managing director, do it in a little more subtle way, because it's not good advice to tell a managing director, go collect fixed and variable costs for me. But that's the reason we don't adjust for operating leverage. Now, adjusting for financial leverage is much more common. Why? Because we know how much debt and equity the companies have. Okay? And the adjustment, the more common adjustment, is called the Hamada beta. And the Hamada beta basically says, if you give me the beta for your business, let's call that the unlevered beta, and you tell me how much you borrow, which you measure with the debt to equity ratio, the levered beta, which is the equity beta for your company, should be the unlevered beta times 1 plus 1 minus the tax rate, because debt is interest is tax deductible, times the debt to equity rate. It's a very simple equation, but it does rest on a strong assumption. It rests on the assumption that all of the market risk in a company is borne by the equity investors. That the beta for debt is zero. It doesn't mean the debt is riskless, but it bears no market risk. You know when the Hamada beta works is if you have a triple B rated company, a single A, double A, what happens to corporate debt and what happens to the equity are almost unrelated. One is driven entirely by interest rates and default spreads and the other. But if you have a junk bond, you know what it starts behaving like? It starts behaving like your stock. So the Hamada beta does break down. It breaks down because of the assumption the beta of debt is zero. It breaks down when you get riskier companies. Now at that stage you would say, oh my God, what am I going to do? Hey, it's not beyond redemption. You can fix this still if you're willing to estimate a beta for debt. So the second approach is actually the more general approach. So if you really want to adjust for the fact that debt sometimes has market risk, you have to estimate a beta for debt. And what that effectively does is it allocates some of the market risk to the debt, to the lenders and makes your beta of equity lower. So pragmatically, here's what's happening. With the Hamada beta, because you're assuming equity investors are the only ones who bear market risk, you end up overestimating the beta of equity, especially at high debt ratios. Remember the cost of capital you did when you're in my corporate finance class? We computed the cost of capital at 80% debt, 90%. When you get up to those really high debt ratios, you are in fact pushing the limits of the Hamada equation because these companies are probably going to have some beta for debt at that very high debt ratio. Again, you've got to ask yourself, is it worth the trouble of making this adjustment? I have never done a valuation where I've estimated a beta of debt. It's really, it changes your cost of capital so little, it's really not worth it. And if your company is so highly levered that you have a triple C or a double C, you have much bigger problems. This is the least of your problems. Okay? But adjusting for the beta of debt is not difficult if you're willing to make an estimate of it. I actually have betas of debt by rating class. Triple A, double. That way you're not sitting there with a single bond and running a regression because God only knows what you get. So if I get to a triple C or a double C and I really want to adjust for beta, I just go pull up the beta for a triple C rated bond and use that in that equation to come up with the beta of equity. So let's review. You start with the business or businesses you're in. You adjust for operating leverage if you can, and you adjust for financial leverage, and that you should be able to do. you end up with the beta for equity in your company. So here's what I call a bottom-up beta. Okay? And I bemoan the day that I called it this because people think it's some magical. It's really, as I go through the process, you're going to see exactly what I'm trying to do. So let's suppose you have a company. You want me to estimate your beta. Here's the first thing I'm going to do. I'm going to come and ask you, what business or businesses you operate in? It's a pretty straightforward question, right? Any company should be able to answer it. Let's play along. Joseph, give me two businesses. Make up a hypothetical company in your mind. Make, you know, give me the two businesses you're in.
Computer software and baking.
Computer software and food. Okay, good. I'll be back tomorrow. Here, actually, don't. I'm actually going to stay here. So, but in the real world, I couldn't do this while I was staying here. So I'd go back to my office. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to find every publicly traded computer software company that I can. And every publicly traded food processing company. You're saying, why aren't you looking for baking companies? Don't define businesses too narrowly. It's asking for trouble. So food processing. Let's say I find 600 software companies and 100 baking companies. And actually, I should be able to do that because, you know, there are lots of software companies. They're all publicly traded, so I can get betas for each of them, right? So I end up with 600 regression betas for software companies and 100 regression betas for food processing companies. I take an average of the 600 betas, simple average. I end up with a regression beta for software companies and an average regression beta for food processing companies. Now, we know regression betas are levered betas because you're estimating the beta for equity, and we know that levered betas are affected by how much you borrow, right? So the 600 public companies also look up their debt-to-equity ratios. The 100 baking companies, I look up their debt-to-equity ratios. Do you see where I'm going to go next? I take out the effect of debt. It's called unlevering a beta to get a beta for being in the software business and a beta for being in the baking business. These are called pure play betas. I mean, there are a lot of little mechanical steps, but that's where you're going. Then I come back to you. I say, okay, you told me you're in two businesses. I know what the risks of the two businesses are. Can you tell me how much value you get from each business? Your first reaction might be, I don't know how much value I get, but I can tell you how much revenues I get. I say, okay, that's a good starting point. 70% from software, 30% from baking. I take a weighted average of my two unlevered betas. I now have an unlevered beta for your company. Last step, I ask you, how much debt do you have? And how much equity? And you might say, I have 20% debt, 80% equity. I'm home. I put that debt to equity ratio in. I come up with a levered beta for your company. Now, why am I doing this? Because I don't like regression betas, right? But where did I get the 600 software company betas? From individual regressions. All I've done is replace one beta with an average of 600 or one beta with an average of 100. So where's the big savings? Law of large numbers is working for me, right? Each of those individual betas can be crappy, but an average of 100 is going to be 10 times more precise. See why 10 times? It's the square root of the sample. So basically, we have 100. The 600, I'm going to actually, what's the square root of 600, roughly speaking? 25 times more precise, roughly speaking? 25 times more precise than any individual regression beta. That's why I haven't used a regression beta in evaluation in probably 25 years, maybe 22. I can remember the early 1990s moment of weakness. I used a regression beta last time ever. Because it strikes me as asking for trouble to put your entire evaluation on this one slice of history. Biggest sales pitch for bottom-up betas is to always be more precise than one single top-down regression beta. Joseph? The one problem with taking averages of debt to equity is you're always one outlier away from disaster because you have this one company teetering on the edge of disaster, you can get a 6,000% debt to equity. Right. Stat 101, when you have outliers that you worry about, what's the advice you're given? Instead of the average, what should you use instead? Median. Just shift to the median for everything then. Okay. Okay? It'll keep you safe. And so there are lots of little, but those are not finance issues. Those are statistics issues. This is a statistical problem now. What we need are statistical tools. And as long as you recognize it, you're not opening a finance book and say, where is it going to tell me? The answer is not there. You need your stat book? Did you sell it off right after your stat? You shouldn't have. Okay? But that's where you're going to go for the answer. Okay? Yes?
up yeah. there because interest is tax deductible.
Exactly.
But like, is the implication of that, like, you know, let's say the U.S. like lowers corporate tax rates, so that means the unlevered betas that you calculate for all your businesses will be lower. Like, I don't understand the intuition. Like, why would that happen?
If it lowers, because in a sense, first your unlevered beta stays the same. Your levered betas will be higher. The unlevered beta comes from the business here. No, the way I calculate it comes from regression beta. So if you lower the tax rate today, that beta was calculated with a different tax when the tax. So I can't replace the tax rate for the past with the tax rate for the future. I'd have to use. Let's say the tax rate is 40% for the last 5 years. These regression betas came from that 40% error. I'd have to unlever the beta. But now you ask me what's going to happen to my levered beta. It's now going to be higher. Do you see why? If corporate tax rates go down, across the board, the same amount of debt will lead to higher levered betas. And here's why. Right now, what's the government doing? It's putting its arm around your shoulder and you borrow money and say, we'll take some of the fixed cost off you. Right? That's what the tax benefit is. If they take less of the fixed cost off you, debt actually becomes less attractive to you. And that's actually going to feed into how much you should be borrowing and what your debt ratio should be. So that's exactly what's happening. The unlevered beta stays the same, but the levered beta going forward now will be higher because your tax rates have become lower.
Okay, yeah. So lower tax rates increase your levered beta.
Exactly. And if you go to a zero tax rate, you bear the entire fixed cost burden. The way to think about the tax benefit of debt is the government is taking some of that burden off your shoulders, right? That's basically what the tax benefit is. And the less they take off your shoulders, the more you have to worry about it as an equity investor. So that's a bottom-up beta, and I'll make my best pitch for a bottom-up beta. And I already have. The biggest savings is that standard error. The larger your sample, the greater the savings. That's the first one. Here's my second reason for using bottom-up betas. Remember you said you were in two businesses, baking and software. Let's say you started the baking business yesterday. The reason was you stood in line for that cronut for $5. And he said, I'm selling software. I should be selling cronuts. You started yesterday. You see the problem I'm going to have with the regression beta for your company is if you started the baking business yesterday, there is zero chance that your regression beta will reflect it because it's not been there long. But if I do a bottom-up beta, I get to set the weights. Not only can I reflect the baking business now, but if you tell me you plan to be in the social media business a month from now, I can bring that into the game as well. I regain control of this process because now my beta will reflect what I planned for you as a company, not what some regression told me the beta was over the last 2 or 5 years. Yes, Eugene.
How would you do that? By adjusting the values?
Exactly. And in a sense, it makes life a lot more difficult, but that's the reality we face, right? Companies are constantly evolving and changing. So you have to tell me what you're forecasting in your cash flows. Remember, the beta is just a piece of the puzzle. So if you're forecasting growth in China and your social media business, well, I've got to adjust your beta to reflect that. I also have to adjust your equity risk premium to reflect it. So it's not happening in isolation. It's happening with what you're telling me is happening on the top line. I'm trying to bring it into the discount rate as well. Yes?
So you said we weight by revenues, but what if we're talking about two businesses such as baking?
Yeah. We'll come back to that. The problem with revenue weights is, what am I assuming? A dollar in revenue in the software business and a dollar in revenue in the baking business have the same value, right? But we know that's not true because you have high margins in one business and low in another, high growth. So I'll give you a little trick we can do to get around that problem. But I stayed with revenues because I don't want to throw that additional complication in here. But when I estimate the beta for Vale, you'll see a very simple way in which I can convert revenues into estimated values. Okay. So my reason for using bottom-up betas is not only is it more precise, but it can be more dynamic. It can reflect your and I can estimate a bottom-up beta for any business, including Snapchat. Right? Private businesses. Otherwise, the only way you can estimate betas with a regression is you're stuck. How the heck are you going to value an IPO or a private business or GE Capital if they decide to spin it off? So it gives me a lot more ammunition. So let me now take you through the process of estimating beta for a company. And some of the issues I talked about will come to the fore. So I decided to estimate a beta for Vale. Brazilian mining company, right? Forget about the Brazil for the moment, because in the beta calculation, it doesn't matter whether they're in Brazil or Argentina or anywhere else. Right? I had to look at the businesses they were in. And these are the four businesses they said they were in. Most of the time, I take the company's word when they say these are the business they're in. Once in a while, I kind of second guess the company. Okay? So here are the four businesses: metals and mining, iron ore, fertilizers, and logistics, what they call a logistics, which is basically they own these transportation services that they use to not only transport their stuff, but other companies' stuff. So another business is there. I went and found publicly traded companies in each space. This would have taken me days 25 years ago. Do you guys all sign up for S&P Capital IQ when I sent you that thing? You have no idea what I'm asking about, right? If I think you might still have time, I'll send it out again, because it's definitely something you should try, if nothing else, because it'll give you, you might have to access something like that in the future. One of the nice things about S&P Capital IQ is you can screen. So for metal and mining, I went and screened for metal and mining companies. It came back with like 150. And because I had a big enough sample, I could afford to be even more discriminating. So I said, you know what, small metals and mining companies might be riskier than large ones. So I screened for large metals and mining companies, because Vale is a large company, and with a sample of 48. You think, only 48. What's the square root of 48? What's the square root of 49? You're pretty close then, right? Seven. So if I use a sample of 48, I'm already getting a beta that's seven times more precise. I'll settle for that. I'd like it to be 10 times more precise. But you see the marginal benefits of going from 49 to 100 is relatively small. From 100 to 625 is not that much. So the precision here is, once I get to about 25, I'm just happy. This is good. I can live with this. I'll settle for 9 over 1, 25 over 9. 49 over 25. But, you know, if I can, I don't have to keep pushing the limits. So I have an unlevered beta for the business. For iron ore, I looked at global firms in iron ore. That's 78. For specialty chemical companies, I had luxury of riches. There were 693 companies that showed up. And for logistics, I looked at transportation firms. So I have, those are my samples. There's my unlevered beta for each of those four businesses. Vale gave me the revenues by business, so that was like the question I asked you. And then I paused and said, you know what? The transportation business and the iron ore business, the revenues are not the same. I should be adjusting these revenues for value, because that's the end game. I'd really like values. So I went back to my sample of companies, the 48 companies from which I got the betas, and I computed a ratio for each company. By taking the enterprise value, you know what the enterprise value is? Market value of equity plus debt minus cash. So it's a market value for the company's operating assets and dividing that number by the revenue. So see this 1.97? A typical metal and mining company trades at about 1.97 times revenues. A typical iron ore company trades at 2.48 times revenues. A typical logistics company trades at 1.14 times revenues. See where I'm going to go next? I'm going to take the revenue and multiply by that ratio. What am I getting when I do that? I'm coming up with an estimated value for each business. Have you ever heard of some of the parts valuation analysts like to throw this around acting like they're doing some pseudo-sophisticated stuff? This is it. I've just done a sum of the parts valuation of Vale. That's all sum of the parts is, unfortunately, in the hands of most analysts, is a multiplier applied to EBITDA revenues. They add the numbers up, they compare to the market, and say, this company should be broken up. And their activist investors actually take that back of the envelope calculation and break up companies. They say, what the heck happened here? But those are the values that I'm going to use, and those give me weights. And you can see Vale is predominantly an iron ore company in terms of value. Those weights have to add up to 100%. So that's the only rule you have to absolutely not break. And I take a weighted average of the unlevered betas by those weights. The unlevered beta that I get for Vale as a company is 0.844. You see the process? Start with businesses, get the betas by business. Get the revenues. If you want to stop there, I'm okay with it. But if you can convert the revenues into values, even better. Take a weighted average of the based on the values. You have an unlevered beta for the company. In fact, for Vale, not only did I get a levered beta and a cost of equity for the company, I did it for each division. I did cheat. You see where I cheated? See the debt-to-equity ratio? I've set it equal for all of the businesses because Vale borrows as a company, and I was too lazy to try to disentangle which businesses had debt or not. If you get a chance, if you go and look at my applied corporate finance book at Disney, which has the theme park business, the gaming business, the movie business, the broadcasting business, very different businesses. There I took the extra step of trying to estimate how much debt each business carried. It was a pain in the neck. I didn't want to go down that road. But this is actually going to be central. If I want to value a piece of Vale that they're planning to sell off, I need that cost of equity for that particular piece. But there's my levered beta and cost of equity for Vale as a company. Now, I said Vale was a Brazilian company, right? How come I didn't stay with just Brazilian companies when I did my samples? What does the law of large numbers need? Large numbers. That's it. It's no more sophisticated than that. If you stay country-focused and you're looking at a Greek bank, God, you're already in deep trouble. You look at other Greek banks, you're not going to get a big sample going. So basically, I've gone global. Not postal, but global. Maybe I should have gone postal. No? And in fact, that is going to be the basis for how... what I do is I start with the local market. If I get 100 firms, just U.S. companies, I stop there. Because there is an advantage, especially with the U.S. markets, because the betas tend to be more reliable simply because they run against the S&P 500 index. Capital IQ does horribly distorted stuff with their non-U.S. companies in terms of betas. I have to actually go in and fix every beta outside the U.S. because they estimate the betas for emerging market companies against this emerging market index that nobody quite understands. And last year when I looked, actually the average beta for all emerging market companies was 0.45 across, which is a problem, don't you think? Something's going wrong somewhere, so I actually have to do some tweaking. So if you could stay with just U.S. companies, great, but if you have to go global, you have to go global. So here's Embraer. Nice thing about Embraer is it's a single business company. Okay, so, Joseph? Start UK. If you get 50 companies in the UK, why look a gift horse in the mouth? You're done. If you get 5 companies in the UK, go Europe. If you get 7 companies in Europe, go global. But if you get the 37, so in a sense, use your judgment because you know that there are differences in regulation, especially in some businesses across. So it's nice to have enough companies in your geographical area that you could stop there. But in most emerging markets, you almost always have to go outside the market. Yeah, because you don't have enough companies. Maybe India and China you can stay within the market, but the beta set gets so crappy for most of the companies in your sample that even there you're better off often going with a global sample. Okay. So you got Embraer, got an unlevered beta, and I did a debt to equity. So this is a global unlevered beta, and I did the debt to equity, and I came up with the cost of equity. So let me play devil's advocate. Let's suppose you do this, and I'm your managing director. I'm a nasty person. Okay. So I said, you know what? It's a Brazilian company. How come you're using these European and North American companies in your sample? So give me your best defense as to why you use global companies to do this.
One, there's not a lot of Brazilian aerospace companies.
Okay.
Two, they sell mostly outside of Brazil.
Implicitly, there are two things here. One is you're saying this small sample, right? In which case, he's going to say, why don't you just use a regression beta for Embraer? That's actually, if you get too focused on it, that's what they're going to push you towards. The other is you got to tell me why the beta for a global aerospace company is a good measure of the beta for Embraer. And your second part of the answer gave the justification. Embraer, Bombardier, Boeing, Airbus are all companies that manufacture aircraft. They sell pretty much the same airlines. They sell into a global market. There's no reason why I should be comparing across companies. Which actually should tell you when you should be a little more cautious about going global. Remember I said the first thing that determines your beta is how discretionary your product or service is? Can you think of a product or service that is non-discretionary in Europe and the US, but maybe discretionary in an emerging market? You see what the question I'm asking? Telecom services, for instance. Developed market, you can argue, hey, everybody needs it. What are you talking about? You look at countries like India and China and Vietnam. Telecom services is actually a discretionary service for a big chunk of the population. If the country does well, you're going to see big growth. If it doesn't do well, it might not. Do you see where I'm leading next? Is if you have to estimate the beta for a telecom company in an emerging market, you might say, look, rather than go global, I'm going to stay with just the emerging markets because this business is discretionary in emerging markets but non-discretionary in others. Valuation is all about making subjective judgments. There's no one set of rules that I can give you. Always use global, because if it were true, then it'd be easy. So you have to make the judgment based on the company you're looking at, the business it's in, and what you think about that business. One final point. If you go end up in Europe or Latin America, it is conventional practice in both those parts of the world to talk about net debt ratios rather than gross debt ratios. And this is, in fact, one of the most common questions I get, because my books are all based on gross debt ratios. If you look at debt to equity, I look at total debt divided by market cap. But in Europe and Latin America, of course, people net cash out against debt. You see, how much difference can it make? Think of what it'll do to Apple. Right? If I net cash out against debt, what's your net debt going to look like?
Minus
130 billion. So it's going to make a huge difference. And of course, the reaction is, if it makes a huge difference, which is the right one? I'm going to say something incredibly strange. It doesn't matter which one you do as long as you do it consistently all the way through. Okay? Let me take, to illustrate that, let me take Embraer. Embraer's gross debt to equity ratio was about 19%. The levered beta I got using the gross debt to equity was 1.07. Its net debt to equity ratio was minus 3.32%. First thing, if you're going to use net debt, don't just stop it at zero, saying, I feel uncomfortable with negative numbers. It doesn't matter what makes you uncomfortable. You've got to stick with the number. In this case, it's negative. My levered beta is actually lower than my unlevered beta. You say, that's freaky. It's okay. See, how can it be okay? 1.07 will give me a higher cost of equity than 0.3. You're exactly right. But where does the cost of equity go into? It goes into a cost of capital calculation. Remind me again how I compute cost of capital. I take cost of equity and multiply it by the proportion of equity, cost of debt and multiply it by the proportion of debt. When I use gross debt ratios, my debt ratio is about 14%. So I'll have 86% equity times the cost of equity plus cost of debt times 14%. When I use net debt ratios, guess what my cost of capital is going to look like? I'll have a cost of equity based on a 0.93 beta. What's equity going to look like if I have a negative net debt? It's going to be greater than 100%. I know it freaks you out again. Stick with it. It's okay. So debt is 103%. You'll have the cost of debt times minus 3%. Guess what? Your cost of capital is going to be roughly the same at the end, because even though your cost of equity is lower, you no longer have the cost of debt dragging it down. What gets people into trouble with net debt ratios is they have these selective things. They'll often, for instance, the number drops below zero, they'll stop at zero, saying debt ratios can't be less than zero. Well, net debt ratios can. So if you're going to use the net debt ratio, stay with it all the way through, including when you get the betas for the businesses you're looking at. So when you do capital IQ, get gross debt, market cap, cash, do the net debt to equity, unlever using the net debt to... So stay with net debt all the way through. You're going to be okay. Just don't go back and forth between the two numbers. I prefer gross debt ratios because cash can be here today, gone tomorrow. You do a big buyback, everything can shift on you. So I prefer to treat cash as an asset for the moment and gross debt. But I'm not stuck on it. So if you insist on using net debt, I'm okay with it as long as you stay consistent all the way through. Any questions on net debt ratios? Yes, Jordan.
Companies that have a negative cash conversion cycle.
Let's come to that. When we do cash flows, we're going to come to that because that's really a negative working capital, basically, that gives you cash inflow. Again, there are a lot
more dangerous to use net,
right? Yeah, so in fact, there are all kinds of issues that come in with those cash flows, so we'll talk about it in the context of cash flows. So everybody get the cost of equity? So let me remind you again, if you have to compute the cost of equity for a company, start by making your currency choice up front. The risk-free rate has to be in the same currency. Make sure it's truly default-free and it's long-term. Your beta is where you're going to reflect the businesses your company's in, so I'd prefer that you use a bottom-up beta. And your equity risk premium is going to reflect the regions of the world that your company operates in. Keep everything in its place and you're going to be safe. Dipendra?
State
country.
So then you should do that.
Yeah.
But then, we also talk.
Betas and risk premiums are two separate issues. What's the average beta across all Indian stocks? Quick, don't even think about it. What's the average beta across all Indian stocks?
One.
What's the average beta across? Betas are scaled around one in every market of the world, right? The reason betas can be compared across markets is not like emerging market companies have low betas and developed market companies have high betas. It's a beta. So the difference between betas and risk premiums is betas are always scaled around one. So whether you're staying country-specific or you go global, all you're saying is I'm trying to estimate the relative risk of this market.
I guess what I'm asking is, like, which market do you use to scale the beta to one? Like, if you said, like, Indian markets relative to Indian markets, then the beta is one.
The only time I would care is if you're a telecom company with half your business in India and half in the U.S. It's discretionary in India, non-discretionary in the U.S. It's almost like you're in two different businesses then. So I wouldn't even think of it as a single business. I'd say you've got a discretionary telecom business, you have a non-discretionary. So it's not the India-US that bothers me. It's the fact that one business is discretionary and the other is not. So then I might use a developed market telecom for the US business and an emerging market beta for the India business. But again, it's not because it's India-US. So even within India, let's suppose you're a telecom company that offers these high-end services for wealthy Indians. And you've got this basic service you offer villagers. You can have two different betas. So that's what I meant about if you feel that different countries that you operate in, your business actually takes on different characteristics, then you might have this challenge of estimating a beta by region. Still, I wouldn't do it by country. I'd still do it by emerging market versus developed market to capture the difference in risk. Yes? This is a classic interview question, right? Can betas be negative, and what the heck does it mean? Anybody want to? Because I actually posted on this a long time back. I said, this is a perfect interview question. Let me ruin it for interviews for the rest of eternity. Okay? First, can betas be negative? Absolutely. What does a negative beta mean? Don't think in terms of stocks per se. I want you to think in terms of macroeconomic risk. What is beta measure? Your exposure to macroeconomic risk. So if you have a negative beta, what are you getting? You're buying insurance against some kind of macroeconomic risk. The key word is buying, right? So how do I make you pay? If you buy a negative beta stock or an investment, what kind of expected return should you have? Think about it. Risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. Your beta is negative. Your expected return. You say, why would I do that? You're buying insurance. I'm going to make you pay. This is one reason, if you're one of those gold bugs, you deserve exactly what you get, which is for the last 39 years, you've got 3% less than the risk-free rate, and they bitch and they moan about it. How unfair this is. Hey, this is exactly what you should get if you put all your money in gold. You can sit there and keep talking to other gold bugs and say, this is so unfair, but it's exactly what you should get, because if you're buying gold as a hedge against inflation, it's a perfectly well-priced asset. If you're putting all your money in gold, that's like the guy running across six lanes of a highway saying, how come I'm not getting rewarded for risk? I took a lot of risk. I could have been run over on lane three. So you've got to make that decision. So betas can be negative. It is very unusual to find a negative beta stock. Here's the reason. When you securitize even assets like gold and you make them stocks, somehow the securitization process makes. So when you get a negative beta and a regression, it could be pure noise. When you get a negative beta for a business, then it's a very unusual business and it's a hedge against some kind of macroeconomic risk. So now let's talk about the cost of debt. The cost of debt is the rate at which you can borrow money long term today. Two key words there. Long term today. You know why I put in the long term? Because I've heard CFOs say, look, I borrowed a lot of short-term debt. My rates are low. Why don't you give me a low cost of debt? Why shouldn't you? Why shouldn't you base the cost of debt on the tenor of the debt that the company actually takes on? In other words, if they borrow short-term, given the term structure, if you borrow a lot of short-term debt, your cost of debt is going to be technically lower, right? Yeah. In other words, you're going to be rewarding companies for doing really stupid things, right? Because what are they going to do then? They're going to take all their long-term debt and replace it with commercial paper and say, you know what, my cost of debt just went down, my cost of capital went down, my value went up. There's a rolled-over cost to your short-term debt, which is going to be roughly equal to your long-term debt. You think, what if I can guess which direction interest rates are moving, then go run a hedge fund. Don't be the CFO of a company playing these games. So you play the term structure saying, I think rates are low now. And if you do, I'm not going to reward you with a lower cost of capital. That's between you and your maker. Make up that, you know, as to whether you deliver that, those returns. So it's long term, and it's the rate at which you can borrow money today. That's the point I made at the start of the class test. It's not the rate. So let's take the easiest scenario for getting a cost of debt. You're a company that has bonds outstanding, and the bonds are liquid and traded. What can you use as your cost of debt? Find a nice long-term bond with no special features, right? No conversion options, etc. Look up the interest rate on the bond today, the yield to maturity. You're done. That's your cost of debt if you're a company with liquid. You know how often that works? 1 in 1,000 times. Because even companies, a lot of corporate bonds are, for the most part, not that liquid. They go into some portfolio manager's portfolio and they disappear for their lifetime. But you could get lucky. Maybe your company has ratings, has a bond, is liquid. You can just look up the rate. And even then, you've got to be careful. And here's why. Can a risky company issue a safe bond?
Yes.
Absolutely. Here's all you need to do. Take your safest assets, carve them out, issue a bond against. And that's why ratings agencies actually have a rating for the bond that can be different from the rating for the issuer. So be very careful about the bond you're focusing on. And I'll make a confession, I never use a single bond's yield to maturity as a cost to debt because I have no idea what I'm getting. But if you have bonds outstanding, you do have a bond rating, right? And here you've got to make a Faustian bargain. If you trust the ratings agency, and that's a Faustian bargain, then you can take the rating and say, they did the dirty work, it's a BBB rated company, this is the default spread for a BBB rated bond, you add that on to your risk-free rate, you're done. That'll take you from 0.1% to 10% of the sample. You still have 90% where neither of these will work. And I'm going to take you through the process of what to do for those companies, but the one thing I want to mention is when you made that currency choice at the start of the cost of equity, that same currency choice should kick in here when you do cost of debt. If your cost of equity is in euros, your cost of debt also has to be in euros. You can't mix and match currencies in the same cost of capital. So here's what I would do if you had a company without a rating. I'd play the ratings agency. It's not that complicated. These guys make it look complicated. It's easy to rate a company. You know why? Because ratings agencies are the most transparent organizations in the world. Not because they want to be, but because of what they provide as output. What do you get as output from a ratings agency? The rating for every company that they rate. And then they give away the game. They give you the 8 ratios that they use. So you go to the S&P website, they use EBITDA to fixed charges, EBIT to interest expense. They give this whole set of ratios. In fact, when I first decided to go down this road of trying to be my own ratings agency, that's what I started with. I started with the raw data of ratings and 8 ratios. Then I did a correlation between the ratings and the ratios. See what I was trying to do? I was trying to reverse engineer how they came up with the ratings. And I discovered something very strange. I discovered that 7 of the 8 ratios were doing nothing. They were there as noise. And that's not surprising because you said, people, I use one ratio to get your rating. You can't then claim this aura of being a ratings agency and asking all those questions. And the one ratio that seemed to be doing the bulk of the lifting was the interest coverage ratio, which is operating income divided by interest expense. So I was off to the races. I said, okay, if that's the ratio you're using, then I should be able to create my own ratings agency. All I have to do is you give me a ratio, I'll guess your rating. I created a lookup table in Excel that I update once every 2 or 3 years. You don't have to update it more often than that because the numbers don't change that much. And here's what it looks like. You compute the interest coverage ratio first for your company, 3.56. You go to the lookup table, and I have 2 lookup tables, one for large market cap companies and one for small market cap companies. Small market cap companies need higher interest coverage ratios to get the same rating. It's not fair, but that's the way it is. Larger is market cap greater than 5 billion. Small is less than 5 billion. I look for your ratio in the right grouping. And all emerging market companies I treat as if they were small companies because they, again, play by different sets of rules. So if you look at 4.56, which is what I got, I'm sorry, 3.56, which is what I got as Embraer's interest coverage ratio, I think the rating I end up with is A-. Which at least in 2003 would have given me a default spread of 2%, but by 2004 the spread was different. You think that's a pain in the neck? another thing that will keep shifting on you. So I'll give you the January 2015 default spreads by ratings class, but don't expect it to stay fixed until May. It could change between now and your final valuation, so I'll give you a way to update that number. But essentially, do you see what I'm trying to do? I'm using your income statement to get a coverage ratio. I'm going to the lookup table. I'm giving you a rating and using that rating to come up with a default spread. That default spread gets added on to your risk-free rate and have a cost of debt for your company. So in the case of Embraer, here's what I end up with. I end up with an A-minus rating based on their interest coverage ratio. The default spread in 2004, which is when I was doing this, was 1%. Now, normally, I just add the default spread to my risk-free rate. And I was doing Embraer in U.S. dollars. So I added to the risk-free rate. But then I had to stop and say, is this right? Because I'm adding a default spread to the risk-free rate, but this is a Brazilian company. You're saying, who cares? Try a little experiment. Make yourself a Greek CFO, and I'll be your banker. You walk into my bank and say, I'd like to borrow money. I say, 30%. So you haven't looked at my financials yet. So you're a Greek company. The problem you face as an emerging market company is you carry two burdens on your shoulder. One is your own risk as a company. The other is the country's risk. It's not fair. I agree. It's much more difficult running an Argentine or a Greek company than it is running a U.S. or a German company. But it's a reality. And here's how I reflect it. I start with the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, and I add two default spreads to it. One is the default spread for the company, which in the case of Embraer is 1%. The other is the default spread for the country. Most companies, I had the entire default spread for the country. In the case of Embraer, I thought that was a little too harsh, and here's why. What did you say Embraer does? It sells in a global market. It gets almost all of its revenues. It actually had less default risk in 2004 than the Brazilian government had, which effectively means that some of the country risk doesn't go through. So I did add some country default risk because you're never going to be completely able to evade that. But because of the way they did business, they didn't get the full weight of the country risk on their shoulders. So the cost of debt in U.S. dollar terms, when you add those two components in, is 9.29%. So the risk, the cost of debt is the rate at which you can borrow money long term today in whatever currency you've chosen to do the analysis in. Now let's add a couple of twists to this process. This synthetic ratings table, the lookup table that I developed, was based almost entirely on U.S. companies. And the reason was, until recently, you really didn't have a lot of global companies that were rated because most European companies, even if they were large, tended to borrow from banks. So my defense until recently was, what else can I do? Increasingly, my sample size is increasing, not only because you're getting some developed European companies, but you're also getting emerging market companies. But at the moment, it's still a dollar-based spread. You see what I mean by that? That 1% spread was meant to be added to a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars. So let's say you're doing your entire analysis in nominal reais. See the problem you're going to run into? The risk-free rate is much higher. Even if your rating is A-, my guess is that A-minus rating is no longer going to be just a 1% spread if your risk-free rate is 3 times or 4 times higher than mine. So the caveat I'm adding here is if you're working in a currency with much higher inflation rates than the U.S. dollar, I'll give you a way to modify these spreads, but these spreads might not travel as well. So this is what the default spreads kind of look like starting in 2008 going through 2011. I want you to focus on just 2008 on one particular rating. Take a triple B rating. That's investment grade. At the start of 2008, the default spread was 2%. Let's say your rating did not change. And I looked at the end of the year. See what happened to my default spread? It went from 2% to almost 6%. And if you remember when I did the equity risk premiums, remember what happened between September of 2008 and December of 2008? As my equity risk premiums were exploding out, my cost of debt was also exploding out. What that effectively means is your cost of capital has to be updated to reflect the spreads as they are today. So I'm going to get you at least started on an updated spread. January 2015, this is what the default spreads look like for different ratings classes. So if you have a rated company, you're already done. All you have to do is go across, look at the 10-year spread, because that's what your risk-free rate is, and add it on. So if you have a triple B rated company, the default spread is 1.67%. You can add it on to your risk-free rate and say, I've got my cost of debt. I'd love to tell you that I did a lot of hard work to get this table. I just paid $45. It's from a site called Bonds Online. So if you get a chance, visit it. Don't pay the money now because it's not been that long, so this is probably going to be okay. Wait. Collect money from everybody in the group because it's the same default spread. So don't pay the money and then ask them for the money and you'll never collect it. So collect the money up front. For $45, you can get a snapshot. And that's all you need. You don't need every minute of every day. Once you get to work, hopefully you can get access to. It's a great site, though, because it's one of the few sites where by rating, by maturity, you can pull up the entire table as of that moment. And if something really large happens in the bond market, I'll go back and pay the extra $45. It saves me. Because if I had to do this by hand, it's doable. I'd have to go find 10 bonds within each ratings class, look up the yields to maturity, average. What a pain in the neck. Okay? So it's don't look a gift horse in the mouth. If you can do this, just want to update the numbers. It's easy to do. Just make sure that, you know. A couple of final points. Embraer used to be a Brazilian government company. Just like Petrobras used to be a Brazilian, And as part of Brazilian government, the Brazilian government was very proud of Embraer, and who can blame them? So they get this subsidized debt from the government, where instead of paying the 9.25% I estimated, let's say they get to pay 6%. This is part of a bigger question I'm asking. You're valuing a company which has special ties to the government and has some kind of subsidy. In this case, the subsidy takes the form of a lower interest rate. When I do my cost of capital for Embraer, should I incorporate that subsidized cost of debt into my cost of capital? You see the question I'm asking? The 6% is lower than the 9.25%. Can I replace the 9.25% with the 6%? Or should I leave it at 9.25%? Yes. But I actually agree with you. But let me ask you a question. Do they get a benefit by getting this lower rate loan?
They do, but it's a similar question to the beginning of class. Yeah. If you had to buy the company, you have to borrow.
But in this case, as an investor in the company, you benefit as well, right? So the question here then becomes broken up because if you buy the company and this benefit continues, shouldn't I show it somewhere?
If the benefit continues.
Let's say it does. Right? Is there a way I can reflect it? What's the benefit I'm getting? Let's make it very simple. I'm borrowing it at money at 3.25% less than I need to, right? So if I take my total loan, multiply by 3.25%, that gives me the amount of benefit I'm getting each year, let's say for 10 years. All I need to do is discount that back at the cost of debt. I value the subsidy benefit from having a below market loan. I think sometimes people try to bring things into cost of capital when they don't have to. When you have a subsidy, my advice is, value the company as if it does not have the subsidy, then take the subsidy and value it separately because it's much cleaner to do it that way. Yeah.
The case for A, so like when we incorporate the tax rate to make debt tax deductible, that's basically an implicit subsidy for debt.
Explicit subsidy.
It's an explicit subsidy for debt.
Well, it's a subsidy that everybody gets. See, the difference here is that you're not getting any special benefit when you borrow money. Everybody in the U.S. who borrows money gets to deduct interest expenses. So it's not like the government came to you. I'll tell you the difference. In the U.S., Tesla did get this below market rate, so it was actually a no interest rate loan early in their life. That's a subsidy because you're specifically being singled out. So if you as a company claim I deduct interest expense, that's not a subsidy. That's actually that's a rule everybody follows, and you're incorporating it to every company's value. So I agree with you. There is a benefit. The question is, what's the best way to deal with that benefit? And I think the reason for keeping it separate is twofold. One is, we know government subsidies don't last forever, right? And if I build that 6% into my cost of capital, the danger I run is if I leave the cost of capital unchanged, I'm acting like they'll keep doing this in perpetuity. The other is, do governments ever do things without expecting something in return? When they give you a subsidy, there's usually another shoe waiting to drop, right? Like what? They might require you to sell to Brazilian airlines at below market rates. And what I actually do when I go into companies which have subsidies and I value the company without subsidy, they all complain. But you're missing our subsidy. I say, okay, let's take your subsidy and value it out. Then I ask them a question. In return for the subsidy, what are you required to do? They say, well, I have to sell it below cost. I have to do this. I say, let's cost out how much that, and then let's compare the two numbers. You know how often you end up concluding that you're probably better off not getting the government subsidy in the first place? It's amazing because it forces you to then ask, why am I begging the government for a subsidy that comes with all these strings attached that end up costing me more than whatever I get as a benefit? So I don't disagree with you that the 6% is a benefit, but I can still capture the benefit by keeping it outside of the valuation and saying this is my benefit, because then I can attach a time span to it and also compare it against what I'm ending up paying in other ways in return for the subsidy.
You said you would discount the subsidy at the cost
of because it's not an operating income. So I wouldn't use a cost of equity because you know exactly what the subsidy is, right? Your only risk is default risk, right? Final step of the process, you've got a cost of equity, you've got a cost of debt, you need weights. Okay. The rule in every valuation book and every corporate finance book is you have to use market value weights. Anybody here doing the CFA? No, nobody's doing the CFA? Okay. Why are you putting yourself through this torture? Okay. What do they do? Read you eight? In fact, the CFA has become a very popular exam, which is a problem for them because they can't have everybody have a CFA. So the way they deal with it is they fail 70% of the people. They made it an endurance test. It's a closed book exam, and they ask you, they make you read 8,000 pages, and then say, what was on page 6,335? You don't know it. You fail the exam. So I don't have a CFA. I'm proud of the fact that I don't have a CFA. But every year they ask me to give their keynote talk. And every year I beg them, please, this year, will you let me write your exam? In my version of the CFA exam, there'll be one question. I'll even make it multiple choice. And if you get the question right, you get all three levels. If the question wrong, return to start the start of the game. So you ready? This is the unofficial Damodaran CFA. If you get this question right, I'll give you all three levels of my version of the CFA. Just don't pass it around and say, this is an action CFA. Might be fraud. Why are we so caught up in using market value weights? And as I said, I'll give you multiple choice, and let's see if you get... Is it because the market is usually right? You see my question? Because the book value numbers are there as well, debt and equity. Why are we so caught up? Because market values are... Let's start. How many think it's because the market is usually right? What's the danger of picking that answer? Let's say you pick that answer, and then you value the company, and you come up with a value different from the price. I've got you nailed. Because at the start of the game, what did you tell me? Oh, the market's usually right, then how come on this particular company you claim it's wrong? Don't ever make that choice, because if you make that choice, you can't do valuation. Is it because market values are easy to get? As opposed to what? Book values? It's right there, shareholders' equity, debt. So it can't be that. Is it because book values of debt and equity are meaningless? Knowing what you do about what I think about accounting, this might seem like the right answer. I wish it were. But they're not quite meaningless. They might not reflect whether the company is right. So actually, I haven't given you the answer. Actually, it's none of the above. You know what it is? Every discounted cash flow valuation is an acquisition valuation, which means you're assuming you're buying all of the equity in the market today and all of the debt in the market today. And what do you pay when you do that? You have to pay market value. You and I might think the market value is wrong, that it's too high, but it's not our choice. This is a transaction-driven view that lets you use market values. That's why we use market values. We're saying, what if I have a private company? We're going to have to deal with that, right? Because you don't have a transaction there. But that's your rationale for using it. It's not that the market is right, but because that's what you have to pay to buy the company. So there's my cost of capital for Embraer. In 2004, cost of equity, I'm doing everything in US dollar terms. Why? Because in 2004, I couldn't even get nominal real numbers. I got a cost of equity of 10.7%. You can see the pieces come together. Risk-free rate in US dollars, bottom-up beta, mature market premium, country risk premium, lambda. The 0.27 is the lambda. So all those pieces come together, cost of equity. Cost of debt, same risk-free rate, country default spread, company default spread, cost of debt of 9.29%, tax rate I'm using is the marginal tax rate for Brazil, because that's where they get the tax benefit. There's my US dollar cost of capital for Embraer. I did do one thing. I took their book value of debt, which was $1,953 million, and I converted to market value. It sounds fancy, but here's what I did. I acted like it was a gigantic coupon bond with a face value $1,953 million and interest expense of $222 million. And I discounted it back at my 9.29% pre-tax. So it's like pricing a bond. So those are my weights. It's about 11,042. So it's about 84% equity, 16% debt, 9.97% cost of capital. Last piece for today. That's my dollar cost of capital, right? Let's suppose I really want to do a nominal REI cost of capital. Sounds like a lot of work. I have to go back to the scratch and do a risk-free rate. And you could do that. You could actually replace my risk-free rate in US dollars with a nominal REI risk-free rate and do the whole thing. My advice is don't go down that route, because that's dangerous, and here's why. Those spreads that I've computed are all based on dollar values, right? And now my risk-free rate is getting much bigger. So here's a quick and dirty way in which you can convert your dollar cost of capital into any other currency. And if you, this is actually a great trick to learn, because you've got to move around currencies. All you need are two numbers, an inflation rate in Brazilian real and an inflation rate in US dollars. Let's say it's 8 and 2. So take 1 plus the US dollar cost of capital, scale it up for the higher inflation. If you're lazy, just add the 6% onto it. But no, I think it's better to actually do the compounding. And what you will end up with is a nominal real cost of capital. So for those of you working in a different currency, this is actually the safer route. Do everything in dollar terms till the last stage, then use the differential inflation to adjust, and you can move back and forth between currencies. And if you want to make it a real cost of capital, no problem. Just take the inflation entirely out of it. You've got a real cost of capital. Okay? So it's a very effective way in which you can deal with different currencies. So that's pretty much it. We'll talk about hybrids and preferred stock when we start off the next class. There's not that much additional, I want to say. But we're going to start on earnings and cash flows on Wednesday. Thank you.